Randolph Scott.
Everybody in the 313.
The Knights of the Round Table.
What's going on, Rearview Movies crew? You know me, I'm Scotty. We're hanging out with Heather and Trevor to take an adventure out to the Old West for a movie. How are you guys doing today?
Yeehaw, man.
I'm doing well.
Not as well as you're going to be when we finish talking about this episode, I have a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, I guess before we jump into the nitty-gritty on Blazing Saddles, Trevor, what have we been enjoying in movies recently?
Well, it's May now, so now we're like officially in the summer movie season. So summer movie 2024 is happening right now. And I saw the first big movie of the summer, The Fall Guy.
Oh yeah, how was that?
That was pretty good. I'm going to say it's a genius masterpiece, but it's certainly entertaining.
Well, I'm sure okay. You weren't expecting Godfather Part 2 out of that.
Well, no, but that doesn't mean I'm not still looking for, you know, the basics of movies to be fulfilled and mm-hmm. everything. but yeah, no, it was fine. It was good. We enjoyed it. It's very funny. A lot of action. They said it's kind of like a love letter to the stuntmen because the stuntmen don't get like any credit.
That's true.
Like the only award those guys really get is at the Screen Actors Guild Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And people have been calling for like a stunt category at the Oscars for years, and it's still not coming. We're getting best casting before we get best stunt work.
Mm-hmm.
So oh well. But yeah, it was neat. It was fun to watch. So Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt is the Barbenheimer mashup I didn't know we needed, but we got it. So, but yeah, no, it was good. It's really good. So I would recommend that one for sure.
I would kind of lukewarmly recommend what I saw over the weekend. I did manage to catch Civil War. It's been out for a little bit, but I did catch it. Without going into crazy spoilers, it is not what you think it is.
Yeah, well, that's good because I think I know what it is.
The movie, I feel like, was marketed as one thing and is something completely different.
Interesting.
Yeah, Kirsten Dunst, actually, I thought, did a pretty good job in her performance. I enjoyed it. It was definitely different than what we're used to seeing her in. But by used to seeing her in, I mean, gosh, it's been a minute since she was in movies regularly. At least it feels like that to me. But I thought she was pretty good. And overall, it was an enjoyable film, but definitely not what I think most people think of when they look at the trailer for that film in the timeline it comes out.
Yeah, I don't know. I wanted to see that, but it's not been... haven't been able to really get to the theaters too much in the last month, so that one's kind of been missed, and oh well, I'll catch it later, I'm sure. It does look good. It's just one of those things where, you know, life gets in the way, and so I don't know, we'll see if I can see that one at some point. It is on my list to see. I do think it looks interesting, but yeah, hasn't happened yet.
I wouldn't say that it is tremendous enough for anyone to get life out of the way to see it. But I would say that if you're talking about movies and their political slants, I would put it next to The Hurt Locker in terms of how political it was or wasn't.
Okay. Well, I would say that one's not super duper political.
That is about where I would place it.
Okay.
Now, you don't expect The Hurt Locker to have a political bent, of course, but I think a lot of people are expecting it out of this film.
Mm-hmm. Just because everyone's like, oh, it's so close to being real.
Yeah, no, it's not. It is definitively not.
Well, I could tell you from the trailer that it wasn't, that it was complete and utter fantasy, because in the trailer they said there's like an alliance between Texas and California, and we know that would never happen.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. If it is something you're interested in, it is definitely a good film in terms of we're looking at war, we're in war, what is it like to be a journalist in war? Those things were pretty crazy, but the fact that it takes place in America has, I think, zero bearing on the story.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been in the Ugandan Civil War and it wouldn't have changed, but probably sold more tickets to do it the way they did it.
Right, that's true. It is A24's highest opening, I think, of their short life.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I think anybody that doesn't know who A24 is should know that them by now.
I would hope
yeah, you see their logo on the front, that should be an instant must see on your list. They don't miss very often.
They had the trailer for some really good ones coming up too. They had a really interesting looking one about a movie coming out soon about a prison theater club. I can't remember what it was called.
What now?
About a theater club that takes place in a prison. Oh, it's called Sing Sing.
Interesting.
Oh yeah.
Or really weird, actually, but yeah.
Looks pretty real. In fact, it's funny, as I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, look, Shawshank.
That was my first thought, but no one was singing in that movie.
Yeah, no, there were no musicals in that film.
No, no.
Well, speaking of musicals, before we jump into our film, I think we should go ahead and get to this. Our movie, as you see by the episode title, is Blazing Saddles. We're going to talk about the possibly divisive, but definitely funny comedy from 1974. But I guess before we jump in onto the top five, because it is part of the conversation, Heather, tell us a little bit about Blazing Saddles.
Okay. Blazing Saddles premiered February 7th of 1974.
Happy birthday.
Yes, happy birthday to you too, Trevor. Many years before we were born,
The third
but
greatest thing ever created on that date.
Right.
this movie is starring Cleavon Little, Gene Wilder, Harvey Korman, Slim Pickens, which I have to be honest, I read this and I was like, did Scotty put that in there as a joke? Because
Nope.
that's pretty funny. Madeline Kahn and Mel Brooks.
That
This
is not a
movie,
joke. That was indeed his name.
I mean, I feel kind of bad now for saying that, but when I read this, I was like, really? Really? Slim Pickens? Okay.
Slim Pickens is the man, or was the man.
Yep.
This movie was directed by Mel Brooks. It was also written by him, Norman Steinberg, Andrew Bergman, and Richard Pryor. And the music was done by John Morris.
Mel Brooks. What is there to say about Mel Brooks, Trevor? I mean, just hilarious. What is there to say that hadn't been said?
Right. The man is comedic gold. He's a national treasure, and I hope he never dies. So he's like the only person in this movie that's still alive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Most, I mean, again, for a movie made in 74, you would expect that for a 50-year-old movie.
But yeah, everyone's gone except for Mel Brooks. So still kicking.
Wow. Crazy.
He's got quite the history. You know, and I forgot that this actually came out the same year as Young Frankenstein did.
Yep.
I forgot that we had these two comedic masterpieces in the same year. We should have watched those two together because, I mean, we could have done that, but I completely forgot that that one came out this year. So, but Mel Brooks, of course, writer, director of The Producers, which is an amazing movie and a really great musical too, because they adapted that for the stage several years. No, not several years ago. It was more like probably 20 years ago now. And then they made a movie of it with the original cast members, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. Awesome. And I think Will Ferrell was in that movie too. So
Uma
really,
Thurman was in it too, I think, wasn't she?
he is, I believe.
Yeah,
Yeah.
because Will Ferrell played one of the actors in it, I think.
He played the writer of the
That's right.
show.
But he was German, wasn't he playing it as a German?
Yeah, that's the part of it. The premise of that movie is and that story is that these guys realize they can make more money by producing a flop than producing a hit. So they look for the worst possible thing they could find, and they find a musical called Springtime for Hitler. Yeah. And
I keep having to mute my microphone so I don't rust ruin the take by laughing out loud, but yeah.
yeah, so they find this script and it was written by this complete Nazi sympathizer. And then I don't remember the musical, but in the original movie they cast like some like 60s hippie guy to play Hitler. Spoiler alert, it becomes a big hit and it's not the big flop that they were hoping for. So then they're
Funny.
staring.
To suck and it doesn't.
Yeah, they're staring down the possibility of this thing running for years and years and years, and that's not in their cards, but that's great movie, genius for Mel Brooks. Also, 12 Chairs, which is really funny. Silent Movie, which is really funny. Young Frankenstein, which we mentioned. History of the World Part One, which is funny. And then they had History of the World Part Two came out as a Hulu series not too long ago. So, and then my favorite, Spaceballs.
Yes,
Gotta love
Spaceballs
that.
was iconic.
Yeah. Actually, I just saw in the grocery store today, I actually saw a chip called Spaceballs. And I had to laugh at that because it's like, I was like, oh, look, Spaceballs the chip.
That's a goofy name for chips, man.
Yeah,
Yeah,
well,
that's
I
pretty
think they were
bad.
like little puff things or something. I don't know. It didn't look good, but I just had to laugh at the name because my mind immediately went there to Spaceballs and not to whatever they were trying to sell. So,
I personally love Robin Hood Men in Tights, the best
oh yeah,
of that group.
how can you not? It's so funny.
The line where Cary Elwes goes, unlike other people, I can speak with a British accent. Dumping
Yeah.
on Kevin Costner.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they do that. The thing about that was I think they nobody spoke with any British accent that I don't think they had. I think they kind of took the Amadeus route and just said, "Hey, speak your normal language, speak your normal accent. We're not gonna worry about messing that up." So,
Right.
because
It
I
would
think
take more away from the movie to be trying to do an accent you can't do.
yeah, so Amadeus did that too. You know, Mozart was Austrian, but here's Tom Hulce, the American, playing him, and he just doesn't disguise it at all. So,
Nope.
I would actually rather you do that than put on some really stupid, terrible accent.
Can you think of a movie where someone really just nailed the accent?
Where they just nailed it.
Yeah, like really, like just did it really well.
Christoph Waltz doesn't count, does it?
No, well, he's German, So,
Right. I know. That count.
well, I was thinking kind of the opposite way, not when an American puts on an accent, but when someone puts on the American accent.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Colin Farrell is really good at that. Like, I went for years, I had no idea he was Irish or whatever,
Oh,
Scottish or whatever he
okay.
is. He was, because his American accent is so spot on that I almost thought he was American for the longest time. And then I actually heard him do an interview and I'm like, oh, okay.
I would
That's
also
cool.
say Bob Hoskins does a pretty good did a pretty good American accent.
Yeah.
Because he did Brooklyn Style in the Mario Brothers flop. He did similar kind of vibe with Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
And then in Hook, was he British in Hook or was he kind of British?
I don't really, I can't really remember. I'm trying to
I'm
like hear
sorry,
the
how can
scene
you
in my
be
head.
kind of British?
I don't know, because perhaps I might be mixing that one up, but definitely in those first two, his accent was very like, dude, guy's from Brooklyn.
I don't think he had a British accent in that one. I don't think so. In Hook, I mean, but yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anybody that can do like, I mean, Emma Stone's was pretty good in Poor Things. You'd have thought she was British if you didn't know who she was. But unless she can do it well, I don't know. There's Kevin Costner was did a terrible Brooklyn accent in 13 Days, or not Brooklyn,
Boston,
Boston,
Boston.
yeah. And then DiCaprio did a South African accent, I think,
Yes.
in Blood Diamond that was not very good.
Not well received, yeah.
Yeah, I tried to do the Boston one in The Departed. That actually worked out a little bit better. But even that one, I mean, everybody put the Boston accent on in that one. And those that have it upped it, like Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah,
He
you
just
got to
like
turn the dial up a little bit.
he went way up on that one. And same with like Matt Damon did the same thing. So we're not here to talk about accents, though. We're here to talk about Blazing Saddles.
No,
Fair
definitely not.
enough.
Definitely not. So, tell us about some of the critical information on Blazing Saddles, including a pretty darn surprising box office take, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really had any thought that this was going to do very well. So they got the budget listed at $2.6 million, and again, 1974 dollars. So I'm not sure what that translates to today, but 2.6 million would even then probably seem to be pretty low. And I mean, this was probably only Mel Brooks's third or fourth movie, maybe, and or fifth if he did this before Young Frankenstein. But already proven to be a good box office draw. I mean, he did win the screenplay Oscar for the producer, so it wasn't like he was still just some new guy just sort of starting out. So he probably was trusted, but only 2.6 million, I think that just speaks for maybe the reaction that the studios were giving him based on reading the screenplay for it. But they were wrong, because it ends up turning a huge profit at $119.6 million, which was good enough for the number one grossing movie of the year.
That is a stupid gross for the $2.6 million budget.
Yeah. And in 1974, 119.6. Again, I don't know what that translates to, but that's an awful lot of money, I would think.
Oh, adjusted for inflation, that's probably a hefty sum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, you look at the movies that came out that year, and that one's sitting there, 119.6 million. And then we have right below that, The Towering Inferno. This was kind of a time when disaster movies were really becoming a big thing. So anything you could do to make a huge disaster movie and load it up with a lot of famous people, that tended to be box office gold. And so Towering Inferno is a really good movie. And that one stars Charlton Heston, and they're trying to escape a giant skyscraper that's burning on fire.
Interesting.
Really good movie. But yeah, so that comes in at 116 million. For third that year, we had The Trial of Billy Jack. I'm not really sure what that is. Honestly, I've never seen it before. Upon looking it up, it is a sequel to Billy Jack. But I don't know what that is, really. A Western movie. That's all I know.
That's a
89
fun
million for
idea.
that. And then Mel Brooks again at number four for Young Frankenstein, 86.3 million for 1974. So Mel Brooks responsible for over $200 million in 1974 box office.
Wow.
So, and we'll just round it out there. Fifth on the year at the box office, another disaster movie, Earthquake, 79.7, almost $80 million for that. And then this year's Best Picture winner, The Godfather Part Two, at number six, bringing in 57.3 million. You could say, well, what was such a huge difference in the price there, box office returns there? That's a 3.5 hour movie, and there weren't
Yeah, that's pretty serious.
There weren't 4,000 screens available, so showtimes are very limited, and there weren't 20 screen multiplexes either. You know, you had like three or four, so you couldn't show it on multiple screens like they do today. So that really, that movie probably only played two or three times a day, where everything else.
You could literally show Blazing Saddles twice in the time it would take you to show one
Oh yeah,
Godfather Part Two.
right,
for
right.
sure. Yeah, it's not like that movie wasn't popular. It very much was. The first one was very popular too, but yeah, so. Let's see. We got our critics and our audience awards over at Rotten Tomato. Critics score was 89, very well received, and the audience score also 91, also very well received. Daring, provocative, and laugh out loud funny. Blazing Saddles is a gleefully vulgar spoof on Westerns that marks a high point in Mel Brooks's storied career. And really, this is kind of one of his legendary movies. If you were to rank them, this would probably be right up there, at least number two, if not number one, probably in all the movies he's done. For sure in that top area. Even our boy Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars back when he reviewed it. Says that there are some people who can literally get away with anything, say anything, do anything, and people will let them. Yeah, that's Mel Brooks, all right, in this movie. Other people attempt a mildly dirty joke and bring total silence down on a party. Mel Brooks is not only a member of the first group, he is the lifetime president and its best. His comedy operates in areas so far removed from the taste that, to coin his own expression, it rises below vulgarity. And he's right. I mean, there's so many vulgar things in this movie that, I mean, there's no way this movie would be made today. There's no way,
No.
at least not by a white guy. So, you know, he certainly does get a pass. I say Tarantino probably gets a pass because he uses some of that same language that Mel Brooks uses in this movie, and he totally gets away with it too. So, but really, really well received at the time it came out, and still to this day, it's still well regarded. At the Oscars that year, it brought down 3 nominations for Best Supporting Actress for Madeleine Kahn. This was her second in a row that she was nominated in that category, but she lost both years in a row. This year, she ended up losing to Ingrid Bergman for her role in Murder on the Orient Express. This was also up for Best Film Editing, and it was up for Best Original Song. A song, the title song, Blazing Saddles, was up for that. Lost in both of these categories to The Towering Inferno, which was another, like I said before, it was a really popular movie, and it was popular at the Oscars too. I think it was probably the second most nominated, if I remember right, but it certainly was up for some of the top awards at that show. So, and then even coming up to today, this movie also appears on the American Film Institute's 100 Years, 100 Movies series. It ranks number 6 on the AFI 100 Years, 100 Laughs list that ranked 100 movies, the 100 best comedies of all time. Number 6 on there, what was it behind? At number 5, it was Duck Soup.
Oh gosh.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, 1933, Leo McCarey.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, real old. Number 4, Annie Hall, 1977, Woody Allen. And then number 3, Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick movie from the 60s. Number 2 is Tootsie, 1982. And then number 1, according to AFI, the number 1 comedy of all time is Some Like It Hot. So, but of course, we have Blazing Saddles there at number 6, but you don't have to go too far down. Number 11 is The Producers. Number 13 is Young Frankenstein. So, I mean, Mel Brooks was well represented at the very higher end of that list. And let's see, I don't know if we mentioned this list when we talked about Ghostbusters, but Ghostbusters is on here at number 28 as well. So, but yeah, it's really, really, really well regarded and highly praised and well respected, and I mean, it's top notch in the world of comedy for sure.
Well, and to add a cosign to that, there was an article from the Tampa Bay Times that was put out in 1993. I think there was a theater in Tampa doing a rerun of Blazing Saddles, and there was some concern, I think, in the article written about, you know, kind of what you just said, that classic line in the film community, hey, this film could not be remade
No.
the way it currently is. But a gentleman noted that Blazing Saddles was, quote, one of my favorites when I was a child, and that Brooks, quote, slapped at everybody, and we all laughed together. By the end of the telephone call, he inquired about scoring tickets to the theater himself. The speaker was Hewitt E. Smith, president of the Tampa chapter of the NAACP.
All right.
That's a pretty good cosign. Now, a member of the Human Rights Task Force at the time said that script probably wouldn't get made. Now, mind you, his task force was more focused on gay rights, so obviously, there are some parts in that that are troubling to them as well. But I actually thought Smith, Hewitt E. Smith, had the best line about it. Mel Brooks is a comedian, a satirist. He only wants to take your $5, give you a laugh, and send you out smiling. I think that's a pretty solid interpretation of Mel Brooks.
Yeah, I would say so.
No deeper thinking, no big societal messages, just, hey, this crap's funny and let's keep moving.
I could have done without all the rape jokes, though. That was not funny.
I
And they
would
mentioned it at least
definitely.
3 times.
It is mentioned more times than I remembered upon the rewatch. But speaking of that, it appears we have come to what will be the central theme of this episode, is that most of the objective world finds this film to be very, very funny. But one of our 3 members of this group, nay, I would say the best looking member of this group, believes that this film is not necessarily funny. So I'm going to give her time to make opening arguments. Heather, why is this film not funny?
Wow. Okay. So I think, first of all, I mean, it's a spoof on Westerns, and those are movies for dudes, right? Like, women don't sit around and watch Westerns. So for this to be a spoof on a Western, I've never really seen one. So I think that's probably where some of these jokes stem from.
Did you think it was funny the first time you saw it?
This was the first time I ever saw it.
You went
Was
40
what?
years without seeing this? Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So watching it with Scotty, when did we watch it? Like, oh, 2 weeks ago or something.
The
That
time
was.
that we watched it, yes.
Yeah, that was like the first time I've ever seen this movie. But I think it's a movie for dudes. It's got a lot of humor in it that I think men find funny, and that's fine, but that doesn't mean that it's my type of movie.
Well, speaking of that, Heather, how many laughs per movie would you say makes a movie that you would find entertaining? So how many times would you expect to laugh at a movie that you would say is funny?
I don't know, for like an actual comedy where you're supposed to be laughing a lot.
Yeah, baseline number.
Okay. I mean, I would assume that you're going to be laughing probably once every, I don't know, in a 90-minute film, let's say. I mean, probably once every 5 to 6 minutes, right?
Oh,
Or
okay.
definitely more. I mean, depending on, how it's written, but
Okay, well, I only ask that follow-up question because I have here on the record,
oh no,
I
here
will
we
submit
go.
as Exhibit A, a list of 7 times that I saw you
Seven? No
either crack a
way.
smile, make a light chuckle,
Oh
or
my
yes,
gosh.
say, that's funny. I have 7 listed examples of this. So, well, Heather, then looking at the evidence, Exhibit A,
Oh no.
when Hedy Lamarr said that a particular solution was too
Headley.
Jewish, you what?
Headley.
Just wait, you'll be able to sue her. When actually, I think too Jewish, I actually think was something the executioner said, but somebody said too Jewish and it got a laugh out of you. When the town of Rock Ridge was doing their singing and they sang, "Our town is turning into sh—" do
Oh,
you
yeah, that
remember
was pretty
that?
funny. Yeah, that was kind of funny.
That was
Yeah.
indeed funny. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Returning to the record, we also have the line about in lieu of pay. When Governor LePetitmane gave everybody the little knockout rubber pieces with the balls on them instead of lieu of pay, the Gucci bag, the Gucci logo on the saddlebag made you
Oh, my
laugh.
gosh. Yeah.
The town of Rock Ridge's
I did
register
not
on the
laugh at
wall with
that, by the
everybody's
way.
last name being Johnson made you laugh.
Yeah, that was funny.
Trevor,
Yeah.
for the record, in case you can't, he's laughing at literally all of these. The Looney
No.
Tunes music when Bart hands off the candy gram for Mongo and it blows up in his face, to the Looney Tunes music where Bart like marches out and puts his hands on his ears. That also made you laugh.
Yes. So, and no, I did not actually laugh at that. I was like, oh, the Looney Tunes music was funny because it reminded me of watching that show when I was a kid, and I definitely did.
Which is pretty much what everybody else thought when they watched it too and laughed.
But I did not like laugh out loud. You
Well,
didn't laugh at the last like 10 minutes of this movie when it went from Western setting to Hollywood backlot? Oh,
You're
that I thought
doing
was kind of
la
funny. I
la.
mean, that was just like very unexpected. Like I did not see that coming at all.
Yeah.
That was part of it.
Was
Shout out
it?
to Dom DeLuise doing that, playing that director too. Doing that whole bit where he was doing the whole it's stick out your tush and having fun with it and just and the line where they ask if everybody gets it and they all say yes. And he makes some laugh about. Now, granted, I fully understand that all of these jokes, many of them are thoroughly colorblind for the era that we live in, but it was definitely still a pretty humorous thing when it all happened. But, and I will say this, these actually, if you're keeping track of the time frame of all of these laughs, they happened pretty early in the movie. So when I got to 7, I stopped. After the Looney Tunes music played and Mongo got blowed up and I had laugh number 7, I stopped counting. So I'm not going to say that you laughed more after that, but you laughed.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things, I don't know. I think it's just guy type humor. And well, I mean,
That's fair. It's guy type humor for sure, especially the campfire scene. Can't forget that.
Yep.
I remember that being a lot longer than it was. I don't remember it being quite as short as it was in on this rewatch.
Ebert talked about that too in his review. He said that it was a great example of kind of the excess of the film, that he thought it went on for a very long time. But I would agree. I don't feel like it went on for a long time either. In fact, I mean, the farting is kind of funny, but Taggart waving his hat around going, "Hot, so you've had enough," is where the line really gets funny.
Yeah, and he comes out just like, oh my God. Yeah, there's a lot of humor in this that kind of comes out real, real fast, too. And that's
Yes.
the stuff I think is funny, where there'll be a line that's almost kind of like the joke is modern and it has no business being in like this time period.
Right.
So that's kind of funny to me. And I remember, I don't re remember exactly when it was happening, but I texted you when I saw it. That was the part where I think it was Hedley Lamarr says, "I'm done playing Mr. Goodbar." are, or something like that.
Yeah.
Like you hear it and you're like, you hear Mr. Nice Guy, but then you stop and think about it and you're like, wait a minute, did he just say a candy bar? So, but actually I'd forgotten, I don't know why I'd forgotten this, but I had some friends, they had a cat for the longest time. This cat lived to be old, old, old. I was surprised it lived as long as it did. And he was a real fat cat too. And they named it Hedley Lamarr. And I'd forgotten that's where this came from. So as soon as I saw him on screen, I was like, oh man, I cannot believe that I forgotten that connection between this cat and this this movie here. So that was kind of funny.
I did read somewhere in my prep for the show that the actual actress did sue the production, did sue the studio after the film came out, and they did settle with her.
Oh,
the real Hedy Lamarr.
Yeah.
Said that they had disparaged her name by putting her in the film. Yes, Hedy Lamarr was a real actress.
Oh, okay.
Something about her name being disparaged by appearing where it did in the film.
Gotcha.
Which is ironic because they wrote a joke in the movie about him suing her.
Oh.
Mel Brooks said something like, come on, this, you know, whatever year it was, you'll be able to sue her.
Didn't he also have a joke in there, too, where he said that they were risking a lot, but he was risking a nomination for Best Supporting Actor?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I did hear that.
I will be risking an almost certain nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
Yep. And he didn't get it. So he lost.
No. But Madeline Kahn did for a musical production about being tired, followed by an attempt to seduce Bart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That whole storyline was weird.
Yep.
So, Trevor, did you read about the joke, the only joke, apparently, that Mel Brooks cut from the film?
Mm-mm.
So Mel, I read, and he said this in a couple of interviews, said that he actually had final cut in his contract with the studio. The studio couldn't cut anything out of it because apparently he signed a contract and it said he had final cut. He could choose to keep anything he wanted. So he didn't cut anything, but he did have one that he got rid of himself because he didn't like it, or he thought he was actually too worried about it. He said he thought it was too much for him. So going to the scene where Madeline Kahn, where Lily von Stupp is getting ready to try to spend the night with Bart, and they eat the Schnitzelgruben, then she blows out the candle and they go to bed after Lamarr tries to bust his way in, and they start, you know, is it twoo? Is it twoo what they say? And then she goes, oh gosh, it's twoo, it's twoo. And the thing that he apparently got cut was there was some kind of weird kissing noises happening in the dark. And the line that Cleavon Littlest says is, well, I don't mean to disillusion you, ma'am, but you're sucking on my arm.
Why cut that?
Apparently that was too much for Mel Brooks.
No, that's funny.
Yeah, he said, I think it was on Conan O'Brien. He said he cut that because he thought it was too far.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, the joke is there without it, but it is still funny. That would still be a funny place to take it.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider
I would have laughed at that, Scotty. Jokes.
Oh, you would have laughed at that? That would have been funny.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have laughed at that.
That's not just dude humor.
But it
humor.
Wasn't there.
Yeah, not just dude humor.
I mean, it kind of is, but for some bizarre reason, I find it amusing.
I'm about to say, you grew up with three brothers. It's not like you can sit here and tell me that you don't understand dude humor.
Oh, I didn't say I didn't understand it. I never said that. I just said I don't appreciate a lot of it.
Nah. Well, speaking of not appreciating it, so according to the notes, in the initial casting, you know, we talk a little bit about casting sometimes. The first person that was in line to play the Waco kid was not Gene Wilder. Apparently, it was John Wayne.
Uh-huh.
They actually wanted John Wayne to play the Waco kid.
Yeah, I can't imagine that.
He actually said he turned it down because he thought it wouldn't fit his image.
I mean, that's probably fair. See, I don't know, like, growing up at that time, I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what everyone really thought of him, but I guess he was kind of seen as like just everyone's favorite Western cowboy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure all the kids loved him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was making movies in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. I mean, so he was in the 74. I mean, he was close to the end of his life at that point. So I can't really imagine him being in that role. You would need somebody younger, I would think, especially if you're calling him the Waco kid. I mean, yeah. Gene Wilder was probably what, 40 or maybe a little less than that when he did this, but
he wasn't a young pup at the time himself. No,
but he wasn't, you know,
he wasn't
John Wayne.
Old. Yeah, true.
Yeah,
but he did give it some high praise after reading the script, where he said he would be first in line to see it.
Well, yeah, smart guy.
But jumping back to Madeline Kahn for a second, they did the line where she did the song, kind of an unexpected musical number. I would say the number even kind of drags in the movie a little bit, kind of slows the pace down. So,
awful.
Do y'all think so? Do y'all think it dragged down the pace of the film?
I do. I thought it was terrible.
I didn't think it was terrible, but yeah, it probably went on a little bit longer than it needed to.
Yeah, I would say so too. I say, you know, the point was kind of made. But that being said, our top five for this episode is musical numbers in movies that are not musicals. So not from musicals. If it is from a musical, that's okay. You can slip it in. But bonus points if you have a musical number that is from a movie that's not an out and out musical. So Trevor, do you want to do this one first?
Yeah, I'll go first. So musical numbers in a non-musical movie, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, well, let's start with Mel Brooks and do the one from Young Frankenstein
Okay.
with Peter Boyle. You know what I'm talking about? Can't remember the song, but that one for sure is in there. Oh, it was what is it? Putting on the Ritz, is that what it was?
Yes, yeah, putting on the
Yeah,
Ritz.
that's it. Just came to me. So yeah, that one, let's start there. And then let's go with one that we'll probably see later this year, the John Travolta and Uma Thurman dance in Pulp Fiction. That's
Yep,
really good too.
it is.
Let's say Wayne's World, the Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yep.
I mean, that can't be beat. I think that's probably the best one.
I still do that every time that scene kicks in and it hurts my
Everyone
neck and I don't
does.
care.
Everyone does. Like you, if that comes on in a bar or something, somebody's gonna headbang.
I play that song in class and my kids have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm like, dude, sorry, it's the law.
It is, yeah. So, and then let's go the ending credits of Slumdog Millionaire. That movie kind of, so Bollywood movies kind of have like big musical numbers in the movies. And so Slumdog Millionaire kind of, as it takes place in India, sort of pays homage to that a little bit. And so the movie closes out with one of those big, kind of big Indian Bollywood musical numbers. I really dig it. And then lastly, we'll go with the scene kind of right in the middle of the movie in Magnolia, Paul Thomas Anderson movie from 1999. Excellent movie. And then right in the middle of the movie, it kind of slows down. And this song by Amy Mann starts playing called Wise Up. And everybody in the movie, it's a huge ensemble movie. There's a lot of different things going on throughout the whole movie, but everybody kind of stops doing what they're doing and they all just kind of sing this song. And it's really good. Like, I don't know, if you haven't seen it, you got to check it out. So that's my five.
Nice. Can't argue with any of those. Heather?
Okay, the first one on my list is Pitch Perfect with Anna Kendrick, Brittany Snow, and Rebel Wilson. And basically every other scene in that movie, someone is singing. And I haven't seen it in a long time, but I really, really loved it when I
Yeah, that
did see
film's
it.
not a musical on a technicality, I would say, but yeah.
No, but okay.
No, it's allowable based
All
on the
right.
criteria we just made up.
Right. It's all right. And then I have Mean Girls with Lindsay Lohan. Her scene where they get on stage and sing Jingle Bell Rock is pretty hilarious. And then I have Saved with Mandy Moore, Macaulay Culkin. That is actually the movie that Scotty and I saw on our first date that was not really a planned date. So there you go.
No, definitely. Yeah, what song did they sing?
Oh gosh, they sing tons in that because Hilary Fay is in this group with her two other friends before they meet the main character, and it's a singing group, right? And I don't remember what they did sing, but I remember enjoying it and laughing at it a lot. Because they sang it like at the very beginning, they sang at the school, like at the school auditorium.
They did.
That movie is awesome,
Yes.
by the way. Yeah.
And then I have 8 Mile with Eminem.
Oh boy. There, that's, yeah. Counts 1000%.
Yep. Everybody in the 313, put your mother hands up and follow me. What? What?
There you go.
Bleep that.
Okay.
As a clip from a movie goes, that is one of the movies that you can watch that clip again and again because it is just so good.
It really is. I love
And
it.
apparently Eminem did that like off the dome for several of those.
Oh, I can believe that for sure. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
That's a good movie with a group of people that have never seen it before. So like in the theater when it first came out, and after he finishes that part of the rap battle, and he basically just like disses himself so nobody else can. And that guy just like stands there blankly, and when he drops the mic after that, and
Papa Doc.
yeah, just the whole audience was just like,
Yeah,
what?
just this little guy you may not know named Anthony Mackie.
Oh yeah, that's right. It was Anthony Mackie, wasn't
Anthony
it?
freaking Mackie. Surprisingly good cast when you look back at it. Is that your one, honey? You got another one?
I got another one. I have That Thing You Do with the Wonders. The
Oh man, that's a good one.
Oneaters. The Oneaters.
Oneaters, that's right.
That Thing You Do featuring the Hollywood actress that I always think Heather looks the most like, personally.
Liv
Oh,
Tyler.
I do. I think she looks like Liv Tyler.
Aw.
I can see it.
Well, there's only one from my list. In anticipation of y'all possibly knocking one or two out, I put down like nine, but I will dump one of them. I will dump Bohemian Rhapsody, which I had ranked very highly, but Trevor made that call, so that's a great call. So we'll give a couple honorable mentions. First, the Catalina wine mixer in Step Brothers, when Will Ferrell completely undoes all of the hate against everybody by singing in Italian.
Oh gosh.
That movie is hilarious. I don't care what you say.
Okay.
Also got to give an honorable mention to Chris Pratt knocking out Come and Get Your Love during the opening to Guardians of the Galaxy, because you know that I thought about it, that moment at that time in that movie was so big, because I remember we went to see Guardians of the Galaxy. I was like, what is this mess? Yeah, I'll go see this movie with Trevor. It sounds like a comic movie, whatever. And then after that, I was like, okay, this is going to be fun. And I think that tone, that scene really set the stage for the film.
I remember you showed me that once.
Some people, you know, we don't get opening credit sequences very often anymore. Usually just kind of save them to the end, which is fine. But those things are like a lost art, you know, because a lot of those times you're sitting there and you're looking at everyone's names and you're like, oh, this is boring, just start the movie. But, you know, if you do it right, it definitely sets the tone for the movie. And so that certainly set the tone for that movie for sure by doing that, because you knew exactly what you were getting in for after that. And looking back at it after the movie's done, you're like, that certainly matched the tone of that film. So,
Well, and the way
but
the credits came in too over the scene, like, because if I remember, the title card came on like when he was in this big, he turned and like sang up, almost like he was singing up at the opening
it was
credits.
like a wide, kind of a wide shot or whatever. And it had a very like 70s sort of look to it.
No, like I said, for that reason, I thought it was excellent. But getting into the actual top five, number five, Deo from Beetlejuice,
Yeah, I
because, you
had
know.
that one and I scratched it. But I'm glad you mentioned it because it is good.
Very good. We'll see if it factors into a lot of these remakes have some fan service in them, so I wouldn't be surprised if we find a little fan service in the Beetlejuice movie, you know, maybe. Number four, I have Matthew Broderick knocking out Twist and Shout in the middle of a parade on Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, that's awesome.
Only one guy had the guts to miss school like that and then sing that song in the middle of a big parade in Chicago.
No way to get caught. No way.
And that would be Abe Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago. Number three, I'm gonna give to Tom Cruise knocking out old time rock and roll in his underwear in Risky Business. Number two, this is where I had Bohemian Rhapsody, but the thing I will sub in for it is when Heath Ledger saying "Can't take my eyes off of you" during 10 Things I Hate About You. Maybe elevated by what ultimately happened with him, but it was still an entertaining scene. And my number one, I'm going to give anybody
Back
who
to the
knows me, this
Future.
is not a surprise at all. Yes, Marty McFly inspiring Chuck Berry to write the song "Johnny Be Good" by playing it with Marvin Berry and the Starlighters at the Fish Under the Sea dance.
That's
Legendary,
awesome.
legendary. They weren't ready for it yet, but their kids were gonna love it.
You're predictable.
I don't really care. That was you know, the only other thing I had is I had, like I said, I had Wayne's World in there at number two, because that was a solid number two, number one fight, but I couldn't knock that one out. Couldn't do it.
Another one that I considered too was Monty Python and the Holy Grail or Knights of the Round Table. Remember that one?
Also a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
This was a pretty wide open category. I figured there was room for a lot of different musical numbers,
I was
but
very excited about this one.
well, and plus it's entertaining. So I'll give you one more kind of did you know here that's pretty interesting. So Mel Brooks said that during the scene at the end where Bart is chasing Hedley Lamarr off of the Warner Brothers set and into the street, when they were getting ready to film the scene, there was a random dude standing on the corner right there as they were coming out of the studio where they would have come. And Mel Brooks told the staff to basically get him off the set and chase him away. They chased him away, filmed the scene, ran it back. He was still there.
Whoops.
And not only was he still there, he had to yell to the producers or the people on his staff to go find the man, because if he's going to appear in the film, he's got to sign a waiver.
Right.
They never got a waiver signed, and the dude is in the film.
Oh, wow.
If you go back and watch the take, it's the scene where again, Hedley's coming out. He's still got the, I think, the pie in his face running off the lot, and Bart's coming right behind him on the horse. And the dude is standing there with like this blue sweater on at the corner. He's standing there not moving, but it's so funny because he keeps turning his head like this is just another day on the studio lot at Warner Brothers.
But I bet you
Funny.
would see some interesting things if you just stood there and looked into that back lot.
Well, and in this
For
case, the
sure.
interesting stuff ran off the lot to him, like the movie happened around him, which was so funny. I would love to find out if the internet could sleuth it up and find out who that guy was and see if he could get his. I'll tell him it was my grandpa if they'll give me some residuals.
Go for it.
Yeah,
What do you got
right.
to
We'll see
lose?
how good that goes.
I mean,
Just my dignity, and how much is that worth anyway?
right. You lost that a long time ago, right?
Exactly. So
Oh, gosh.
we've already kind of touched on this. Could a movie like Blazing Saddles have been made today? Most people tend to agree no, with a lot of the humor, with a lot of the lines. I do think he was a pretty equal opportunity offender in that regard. I don't think he really offended one group more so than the other. But the question I do have is, if you were going to try to make a movie in the spirit of Blazing Saddles today, how would you do it? Because again, you couldn't make Blazing Saddles, same idea, but how could you make a movie in that spirit as a parody? What do modern parodies do now that Blazing Saddles did better?
Oh, they do too much now, I think. I think they're like, okay, we're gonna do like all these Not Another Whatever movies that came out, not another teen movie or epic movie or
Disaster
even,
movie, superhero movie, all of them.
yeah, like their scary movie, you
Date
know, like
movie.
they're obviously referencing a genre of movie, but then what they do when they go in there is they actually pull certain references of those movies out and make fun of those, right? So you're watching this and it's like, you know, like scary movie, let's look at that one. That's not a bad movie. I like that one.
No.
Okay, but let's pull that one apart for a second. That's obviously referencing Scream, but then they have, you know, some other movies that were coming out around that same time that they were kind of referencing too. Like the I Know What You Did Last Summer was in there, but they were obvious that they were focused on those movies. And you had like David Arquette was in Scream. What was his character's name? Was Dewey. And they had a
It was
they.
Doofy.
They pun that with Doofy, right? And that's exactly what they're going after here when they do that. And then there's just scenes from movies that they're making fun of. It's like a Weird Al songs, you know, like Weird Al will make a parody of a song and you know exactly what the song is because he's making the parody of it and sounds the same and everything. He just changes the words up, like his Coolio Gangster's Paradise, and he makes Amish Paradise. And it's the same beat, it's the same melody and
Just
everything,
eat
and
it.
just different, yeah, just
White and
different
nerdy.
lyrics. And that's what I would equate those types of movies to. But like this one, this is referencing again a whole genre, but it's not spoofing something specific. It's spoofing the whole thing as a whole. Like what are these movies in general? How are they related? You know, like you can't look at this movie and say, oh, they're spoofing True Grit or they're spoofing The Searchers or any of those other like classic. They're spoofing The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I mean, they're not looking at specific movies, but then you look at like Scary Movie, it's like, oh, they're spoofing Scream, you know. I just don't, you know, and maybe those date movies and epic movie and not another teen movie, maybe those may be a little bit more broader, but again, when the humor comes up, it's pretty pointed what they're doing, right? They're making fun of this specific scene from this specific movie, and I think this one is just it's making fun of the Western genre as a whole. And that's where I think, and while I love Spaceballs and I love Robin Hood, right? Those are probably two more of his weaker ones, right? Because of how narrow of a scope they are spoofing at that point.
That's true.
So
Because
that's
Robin Hood
why
Men in Tights at that point, at that point is spoofing Robin Hood movies mainly.
it's specifically Prince of Thieves. You know, you had Morgan Freeman playing Azeem, and then you had this
I
guy,
sneeze.
a sneeze. Was it Dave Chappelle? Is that who it was?
It was.
Yeah, a sneeze, son of a chew. Bless you.
Oh no, really?
Yeah,
Really? Oh
yeah.
gosh.
And that was one of the gags throughout the whole movie. I am a sneeze, son of a chew. Bless you. Everyone just say, bless you.
Oh, good
Right.
gracious.
Being delivered by Dave Chappelle,
Oh, that's
right? I mean,
bad.
again, you look at like you hear names. Oh man, Dave Chappelle's in the movie. Yeah, that movie was funny for that reason.
Yep.
And
And not
Spaceballs is spoofing Star
Star
Wars,
Wars.
and that's
And not
it.
to say anything bad about any of those. I love those. I think they're great. But if we're ranking all this stuff, it's these older ones when he didn't have a specific target, I think is where it was really. If there's any spoof, one that I thought of when I saw this again, because I'd actually forgotten the whole ending of this movie. It had been so long since I'd seen it, and I forgot they ran off. I remember when I saw it, I was like, oh damn, I forgot this was Blazing Saddles was where this took place. But I couldn't help but think that he may have been pulling from the end of the movie The Quiet Man, which is a John Wayne movie from 52, I think. And that movie kind of ends like that too, with this like hilarious run through the town, everybody's beating each other up kind of thing. Not a Western per se, because it takes place, I think, in Ireland, maybe. I can't remember. But it's John Wayne. So, I mean, that's, you can't not look at John Wayne and not think Western, even though this isn't really a Western movie at all. But that movie kind of has that same sort of ending to it. It's pretty slapstick. It's pretty silly. It's not quite as absurd as this. But when I was watching this, help but think, like, you know, maybe Mel Brooks was kind of pulling from that movie specifically to get this.
Well, and there's definitely more to pull from in a movie like Blazing Saddles versus a Spaceballs or a Robin Hood Men in Tights, because there are some small topical jokes in there. In fact, it's kind of funny. I never understood this as a kid and had to look it up when I saw it older. When Bart is trying to convince the townspeople to do something, and they're like, "We will not do that. We'll do that." And he just goes, "Will you do it for Randolph Scott?" And then they break into this like chorus of Randolph Scott, and they all take their hats off like they're saluting the flag. But that was an homage to an actor who played in Westerns, which again, that's a topical joke. You had to look that one up to understand it.
Well, there's The Searchers, another really old Western movie. I don't know if you've all seen it or not, but that was also John Ford and John Wayne. And there's a shot in that movie that's kind of iconic. And I don't know if everyone calls it the Searchers shot, but that's what I call it. And it's nothing fancy. It's just the camera's shooting from inside the house through the open door and looking out at the vast landscape. And I don't know if anybody had really done it to that kind of effect before the Searchers had, but ever since then, anytime you have a Western movie, someone does that. I mean, it doesn't even have to be a Western. They do it in Inglourious Basterds right at the beginning when she's running away from the house and Christoph Waltz steps out and
They open the door and he comes through the door in the shot.
that's, yeah, just the first shot of the door open and she's running down that field. I mean, that's the Searchers shot. And you see it in a lot of stuff. Spielberg has lifted it because he loves John Ford movies and it's so popular, right? And I don't think that shot is in this movie. And if you're spoofing Westerns, that would kind of be something that you'd want to throw in there. But I think he made a deliberate choice not to include that particular shot in this movie.
Interesting.
Maybe it was. I don't remember seeing it. And I think that if you're spoofing a Western, why not spoof that shot? But that's, I think, where he's not wanting to seem super deliberate on which movies he's making fun of. He just wants to spoof the genre as a whole. And the second he puts a camera in a doorway, now he's spoofing the Searchers. And I don't think he wanted to do that. So I think he deliberately avoided that there. That's just my thought. Maybe I'm overanalyzing it. I don't know, but.
No. Look, when you talk about overanalyzing, there was one gag I had to look up because I didn't know it, and it would have been a very, very smart joke at the time. So there's a scene in the movie where Pedley pulls out a two-shot Derringer and he fires it three times. Now, so it's called a two-shot Derringer for a reason. It's only got two shots in it. Like, you have to reload it after you shoot it twice. But apparently that was a common gag in Westerns. Somebody taking a gun that couldn't fire but so many bullets and firing way more bullets than they could. So they made that as a very subtle joke with Hedley Lamarr had a two-shot pistol. One of the little mini one he had that was very small and popping off three shots with it, which he could not have done because it only the goof was on purpose, I think is what I'm saying. And that is incredibly smart for a movie that would be billed as a lowball spoof.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, everything's deliberate, I think, in movie making, especially when you get a person as well versed as Mel Brooks is. I don't think you're gonna, anything's just gonna end up in the screen by accident. So.
Do you think, Trevor, the film would have been funnier if Mel Brooks had been able to convince audience to convince the studio to hire Richard Pryor?
So that's the age-old question because Richard Pryor, of course, helped write this movie and my guess is they probably wrote the movie with him in mind, and they probably the studio didn't want him because he was Richard Pryor. You know, he's
Right, drug
not,
problems, mental health problems,
yeah,
and
right.
really, really vulgar stand-up.
He's not exactly probably the most reliable person to get to show up on to
On
work on
set,
time. You
yeah,
know, yeah,
for sure.
right.
But iconic in terms of comedy.
Yeah. So, and all the love to Cleavon Little because he's great in this movie, and we've talked about this before. It's like, how can you not? You know, you say, oh, that wouldn't work,
Right.
but
Yeah, certain casting choices, yeah.
yeah, but this one, yeah, Richard Pryor is certainly missed in this, I think. And I think he would have really done a exceptional job in this role. And again, no disrespect to Mr. Little,
Not at all.
but I think that Richard Pryor would have taken this to a whole nother level.
Well, and there are a couple of films that you can watch with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor to know that the chemistry would have been there,
Yeah, and
thousand
that's
percent.
for sure.
But it also probably would have changed the dynamic because with Gene Wilder and Cleavon Little could be the straight man, Gene Wilder could be the funny man.
Right, yeah.
I think Gene would have probably had to be the straight man if Richard Pryor was in it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah.
I don't think that Gene Wilder could have been the funny guy because he would have had to be the straight guy. Or they could have both been the funny man and it would have changed chemistry altogether.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen what Richard Pryor would have done with this, because but I never watched this thinking like, oh, this guy's just doing a Richard Pryor impression, you know?
No.
Like he did make it his own, and he did do his own thing, but yeah. Actually, I'm just
Absolutely.
remembering as I'm talking about referencing specific movies, there was a specific reference in here that I just forgot about, and that was another one of these great Western movies, one from the 40s, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre with Humphrey Bogart. Great movie. But when they're handing out those badges toward the end, and they go, "We don't need no stinking badges."
Vamanos, yeah.
That's right from Treasure of Sierra Madre. So, but that might be, if that's the only reference I can think of, then that's pretty good.
So Heather, I guess for one more time for posterity to kind of close the book here, give me your take on the first watch slash rewatch of Blazing Saddles.
There are some parts of it that were definitely funny, but there are some parts that just made me kind of roll my eyes and go, yeah, okay. Mel Brooks is a funny guy, and it's hard to say that he's not, but I do think this is a guy movie. It's a movie for dudes. And, you know, when you look at a spoof on Westerns, that's kind of what you're going to get. So it's not bad, but I wouldn't sit down and watch it again.
That's what you think. We're going to watch it tomorrow night.
No, very funny.
Trevor, how about you? Between the first watch and rewatch.
I mean, that's Heather's point's fair. It is probably a dude's movie, and I laughed the first time I saw it, and I laughed this time too. So it definitely doesn't lose anything. If anything, I think it's improved in its humor in the last 50 years because you don't see this kind of stuff anymore. And the fact is that this, what they're doing here, is okay to do. People don't need to be so uptight about things and be offended on behalf of somebody else all the time. And
Yes.
that's, I think, the issue here is like people going through and looking at the script and finding, oh, we don't like this piece because it's offensive to these people. It's like, you know, did you ask this person? Did this person speak for the entire group? I mean, I don't understand. And so if they're making fun of, you know, certain groups of people, laugh. That's this. We're in too serious of a world to have to police everybody's humor every day. So let's just laugh at what is funny, and things are funny. So I'm sorry, this movie's hilarious. And if I'm laughing at somebody or a group that is offended by the joke on the screen, then whatever. I'm still laughing at it because I found it funny. That doesn't mean I have any hate or malicious intent or anything like that. It's just it's humorous. So let's just all laugh and move on.
Well, and honestly, I think that's where people maybe in our current age understand or are misunderstanding the definition of the word satire.
Right.
Because satire is not just being funny, it's being funny to make a point. So, for example, I used to make this example all the time with my kids when I used to talk about it in history. We talked about Voltaire and some of the things he wrote. If you look at Family Guy, for example, Peter often mistreats Meg, treats her terribly. You know, Pe Meg, why are you allowed to speak? And just treats her completely terribly. But it's really to make the point that some dads do treat their kids like that, you know,
Well, yeah,
and it's, you know.
he'll beat her with a baseball bat, you know.
And it's not, of course, saying that all fathers and all fathers do that to their kids, but some do. And kind of this, you know, again, on a film like Family Guy, you're like, well, not all dads are crazy like that, but you know, one or two are. And same thing when you're talking about, you go to The Simpsons. We looked at, gosh, look at The Simpsons and how much they got right about modern politics. I mean, and I'm not even talking the, you know, dude coming down the escalator prognosticating. I mean, like having the politicians essentially tell the truth out loud about, well, I just needed more money, so we're going to do this. And, you know, really kind of got it that way too. And so if you think about it, Mel Brooks's portrayal of Governor LaPetite is pretty funny and a pretty realistic spoof. You look at how we feel about politicians nowadays, it's not that different from how they felt about them back then.
Yeah, that's true. Well, even you look at like all the campaign slogans from presidential races in the 60s and the 70s, and it's all the same they're saying today. It's like, oh wow, nothing's changed.
And I guess to close the book on it with my take, this movie has some sentimental value to me because a lot of us remember those first couple movies that we watched with our parents that we connected over. And ironically enough, this is a movie me and my dad connected on. And so we, again, my wife is absolutely correct. Some of the humor in this is, a lot of the humor in it is guy humor. I, in fact, am a guy. So I laughed quite a bit at this with my dad. We still laugh about it. In fact, I got a shout out to him. I know he's going to listen. I love you, Dad. And yes, they have had enough beans, entirely enough beans.
Oh, gracious.
But no, I do think the film gets funnier because I think as you get older and smarter, you notice more things. And I think that's the mark of really good comedy is you laugh at one thing at one point, but if you can make somebody laugh in a different time period much later, you've written very good comedy.
I like that.
So, and again, if you think the movie's not funny, that's one thing, but there's a very subjective and objective element to this. But if the vast majority of people who watch this think it's funny, you're really going against the grain to say it's not funny at all.
Yep.
But anyway, so before we ride off into the sunset here on Blazing Saddles, we do have to take care of some business, making sure we don't get whammied with our next movie. I really don't want to see Scary Movie 3, so I need
Oh,
to find out
no, I
what the
don't want
next
to see
movie
that
is.
either. No, that
I
would
don't
be
know.
awful.
The
It's not
Exorcist
on
is
our.
still on the board, though. Or is The Exorcist not on the board this year?
That was
No,
last
that was
year.
last year.
Oh,
Yeah,
man.
whew. We avoided that. I don't know what's on the board for scary stuff this year. So, scary movie's not, I know that, but let's roll the dice here. Here we go. And stop. Okay, Heather, you might actually like this one.
Oh, sweet. Is
Yay.
it Texas Chainsaw Massacre? That came out in
Yes, oh,
74. It
very
is.
funny.
Yeah, that did come out in 74. Yeah. Yeah, that is a possibility. Hold on.
Gosh.
Did we get it?
No, we are going to 2004. So
Play the
our
Price Is Right
20.
music. I'm
Oh,
disappointed.
okay.
Bump, bump, bump,
Boo.
bump. 20-year-old movie here. Let's go Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh my
Hey,
goodness.
that movie was awesome.
Yeah. Well, last time you saw it, it was. Let's see
Yeah,
if it still holds up.
that's true. It was a total mind trip,
Yes.
but I'm intrigued to see it again.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's been a long time since I've watched that one, so I'm looking
Yeah.
forward to watching this one again.
We need to stop, clip that, and put that at the beginning of every episode. My wife is just explaining how happy she is to see a Jim Carrey film.
Yeah, true.
Because he wasn't crazy in that
Yeah,
movie.
this isn't
Are you kidding?
Jim Carrey, Jim Carrey. This
Right.
is thespian Jim Carrey.
It's not over actor Jim Carrey, it's serious
Yeah.
Jim Carrey.
Well, he's only had a handful of those, so we gotta hold those in high regard, and this is one of them, so
No,
yeah.
certainly deserves to be in high regard. Very kind of groundbreaking in its way. But that's the truth of it, folks. We're gonna go ahead and ride off into the sunset here. But we are very excited to take a very cerebral look at breakups with you next month as we look at Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. In the meantime, tell us what you think of the film and what you think of our takes on the film on our socials. And we look forward to continuing to look at old films with new eyes.